Well, this last week, I want to share with you that I took home improvement to a new personal level. I mean, I learned to paint this week. Now, there were some events this week that if you would have seen me afterwards, you'd say, you don't know how to paint. I mean, I had a blob of paint in my hair at one point. You get the paint behind here. You're wondering, how in the world did I get paint back here? Well, listen, I learned to paint this past week, and it was with the help of my friend and neighbor, Nick Higgins. Higgins Premier Painting. I mean, he took home improvement to a new level with me this last week. He let me use his Finish spray gun. Now, he has a Graco Finish paint sprayer. He told me it cost about $1,400, which scared me to even turn it on. You know, I'm like, oh, what if I do this wrong, you know? But here I am, I'm outside, and I'm painting these bookshelves that are supposed to go back down in our basement, and my wife's really into earth tones. Any ladies here, really, you're into earth tones. Please help my wife out and just raise your hand anyways. Yeah, we're into earth tones. Honey, I'm into earth tones too. Well, we're into earth tones. And if it's not fashionable, it is now, right? We're into earth tones. I'm out there spraying these bookcases, and I realize it seems as though I'm spraying liquid mud onto these bookshelves. And yet I paid $41.39 for each gallon of this paint. Why? Yeah. So I look down at the cover of the paint can, and it says the color name on it. You know what the color's name is? Quagmire. Now, I don't know when the last time you used that word was, but it kind of rolls off your tongue, and so I said it a few times in my head. Quagmire. Liquid mud. That's what it is. And I started thinking, why is this $41.39? And then I thought, well, we're in the desert. They had to import this mud. So that's probably why. But here I am, and I'm learning to paint, and I'm doing these home improvement things, and I'm thinking about quagmire. Like, what a weird word. Like, wow, bog, miry, clay, mud. And then I started thinking about our psalm this week. Do you know that Psalm 40 talks about quagmire? Now, it doesn't use that word. It uses a bog or a pit of destruction. But actually, in this psalm, it's talking about muck and mud. It's talking about quicksand. It's talking about the type of gooey, slimy ooze that when you step on it, it squishes out and you sink down in. Have you ever stepped in mud so deep you lost your shoe? Or maybe your kid has, and he comes with one muddy sock and says, Dad, I lost my shoe. And then you end up digging through the quagmire, right, trying to find it. Well, in our psalm this morning, what we find is we find David in the quagmire. We find David sinking in miry clay. It's as though he's found himself in the midst of a bog. Now, you may stop for a moment and say, okay, so we're talking about a guy who got stuck in the mud? Not literally. He got stuck in the quagmire metaphorically. He got to a place in his life, a place where maybe you've been recently, a place where maybe you are this morning. A place in life where it feels like you're just sinking. A place in life where the trial is actually so heavy, it seems like it's closing in around you. A place in life that can't be described any other way than like quicksand or bog or muck or mire just closing in and almost suffocating you. It's that sort of a trial in your life. It's that sort of a struggle in your life. A struggle that's like a bog or a pit or miry mud. A situation in which extrication is very difficult. It's hard to get out of it. It feels like you're just stuck there. And actually the trial is kind of pulling you down. Sometimes we face things in life where we actually feel like the difficulty is dragging us under. Like, I don't know if I can actually keep my head up. I feel like this trial is so heavy in my life. I wish I could just escape, but it sucks you down deeper and deeper. Notice in the psalm, verse number 2, David is going to say, God drew me up from the pit of destruction out of the miry bog. David is talking about some event in his life that was like quagmire, some trial in his life that was difficult. Now, we could think about, like, well, what is it? What is it in David's life that he's struggling with here? What kind of pit is he in? How is he sinking? How is he stuck? maybe it was the pit of rejection. Because, you know, when David was to become king, he was hated by Saul, just rejected by someone he tried to serve. Maybe it was the pit of rejection. He just felt like, man, this is a heavy trial and I can't get out of it. Or maybe it was the pit of family problems. You know that in David's life, he had plenty of those, didn't he? Different sorts of family problems that just didn't seem to find resolve. They seemed to get more and more complicated, actually. Maybe it was that pit that he's talking about. Or maybe it was the pit of sin. You know, sometimes sin is this big trial in our life. Like, maybe there's a sin issue in your life that you've tried to ditch. You've tried to get rid of. You've tried to fix. You've tried to clean up. But you find yourself right back in it. I mean, it's just this issue that seems to suck you in like a pit of quagmire, a miry clay. You're stuck. Maybe it was David's sin. Or maybe it was just David's loneliness. You know, in his life, he was deserted by many of his friends. Maybe that's the pit he's talking about. But the fact of the matter is, you can read Psalm 40 over and over and over again, and you're not going to know. You're not going to know what the exact pit was, what the miry clay was, because the psalm just doesn't tell us. And perhaps that's intentional. Because if it told us the specific pit that David was in, maybe then we'd only apply this passage when we get in the exact same pit. But because it's broad, because it's just, listen, trials, miry clay, quagmire, things that cause you to get stuck. Maybe since it's general like that, maybe all of a sudden when we read Psalm 40, we can find ourselves there. Maybe our situation can soon be applied in this text because it's kind of zoomed out. It's kind of like, to me, I was thinking it's kind of like Paul's thorn in the flesh. What was the thorn in the flesh? We don't know. But sometimes we feel like we've got a thorn in the flesh. And we apply those principles to our lives. And so perhaps here in this text, whether it's a family problem, rejection, loneliness, sin, or some other issue, perhaps this crater of quagmire, this ditch of difficulty is something we can relate to this morning. Now, I'd like to make this pit in verse number 2. You can write this in your margin. I'd like to make an acronym out of it just to help us as we go through the text. PIT. P-I-T. Personally intense trial. What do you do when you find yourself in a pit? A personally intense trial. Whatever it is for you, what do you do when you find yourself in a pit? Some sort of trial that's sucking you down, some sort of trial that seems to be drowning you, some sort of trial that paralyzes you, suffocates you, pulls you further and further from freedom and joy. What do you do when you're in the pit? That's what I'd like to talk about this morning from Psalm chapter 40. Perhaps your pit this morning is the ache of infertility or the squeeze of financial difficulty or the fear of a medical condition or loneliness of singleness. Maybe the bog is a sin struggle in your life or an addiction in your life that snares you and sucks you in. Maybe it's the ache of depression or chronic feelings of fatigue that just won't let you go. What is your quagmire this morning? What is your bog? What is your pit? Your personally intense trial. When we find ourselves in the pit, what do? The psalm breaks it out for us and guides us to proper responses when we're sinking in the pit. The first thing we're going to see in the text is that when we're in the pit, we need to recount the goodness of God. So what do when you're in the midst of your personally intense trial? What do when you're sinking? The first thing we find in this text is that we need to recount the goodness of God. I want to pause for a moment because that's actually not our natural response. Like when you feel like you're suffocating in life, when you feel like you're stuck in a bog, is the first thing you do just to pause and say, God, you're just so good. You're good. But that's really not what we normally do. We're like, God, get me out of here. You know, like it's like this cry for escape. It's not usually a cry of praise. But notice what David does. His first response is to recount the goodness of God. I want you to picture David. He's sinking in quicksand. It's going deeper and deeper. It's coming closer and closer up to his neck. And he just kind of is calm as he sinks. He says, come a little closer and let me tell you about the goodness of God. That's just not normal, is it? That's not our natural response. And yet here in this text, that's what we're called upon to do. The opening of the text surprises us with the fact that when we're in difficulty, when the trial is sucking us in, we need to recount the goodness of God. When we're neck deep in muck, the first thing to do is call upon God and recount his blessings. Stop complaining. Stop blaming people. Stop cursing. Stop mumbling. Stop furrowing your brow. Stop looking for the escape hatch. Pause and recount the goodness of God. In present trials, we need to find strength in the past works of God. So I want to set the stage for you. The text was read, but I want to tell you that this text is actually broken into two pieces. In verses 1 all the way through verse number 10, that is David looking backwards. He's looking at a past event. When you get to verses 11 through verse 17, it's David in a present circumstance. Now, just to set the stage, look at verse 11 through 17. I mean, is he in a good spot? I mean, is life really rolling for him? Is it going well? I mean, when you look at verse 12, are you thinking, man, he's got the easy life, the gravy train. Things are going great for David. Look at verse 12. Is that what you see in David's life? No, in verse 12, it's evils have encompassed me beyond measure. My iniquities have overtaken me. I cannot see. You look at verse 14. Let those be put to shame and disappointed altogether who seek to snatch away my life. Verse 15. Let those be appalled because of their shame who say to me, aha, aha. What's going on in David's life presently is that he's got enemies, he's got iniquities, he's got evils. They're sweeping over him like waves. They're surrounding him like enemies. Life is a pit. That's the present tense. 11 through 17 is the present tense of David's life. And while he's in that pit, he looks backwards and recounts the goodness of God. That's what verse 1 through 11 talk about. So he's sinking in the muck, and he begins to say, pull up a chair and let me tell you about the past works of God. Let me tell you about a time when God delivered me in the past. You're watching him sink. You're like, someone needs to do something. But he's like cool as a cucumber. And he's telling you a story. I mean, it's kind of odd. It shocks us. It grabs us. He's sinking in the muck of enemies and evil and his own iniquity. And he's just in this bog. And he says, well, let me tell you about a time in the past when I was in a bog. Verse number 1, I waited patiently for the Lord. What does that mean? I waited patiently for the Lord? Sinking. He's waiting. It's not the tapping. Have you ever waited and you're like, that's not patient waiting. I mean, that's like this irritated frustration of having to wait. It's not the tapping of the fingers. It's not boredom waiting. I mean, he's not yawning in the background like, yep, guess God will get here soon. No, it's not that. When it says he waited patiently, it's actually a Hebraism. It's like this repetition in the Hebrew. And basically it means this. Expectantly, I expected the Lord to act. So here he is. He's sinking. He says, let me tell you about a time when I waited patiently, when expectantly I expected the Lord to act. I actually had faith that God was going to do something. I waited, kind of like a watchman would stand at the wall at night, and he couldn't wait until morning. Can you imagine being a watchman in ancient Near Eastern times? It was your job during the whole night to watch the horizon in the dark, see any movement, and make sure that no enemies were coming. I mean, you had to be alert all night long. And do you know what those watchmen waited for? They couldn't wait until morning. Until these rays of light, the break of dawn, lit everything up, and they were relieved of duty. Like, phew, we made it safely through the night. They're anticipating. They're hoping in. They can't wait for daylight to come. Or maybe the wait of a near grandmother. I say near grandmother because it's a woman who's going to have her first grandchild, and she can't wait. I mean, she can't wait for her daughter to call and say, it's coming, it's time. And so she carries around this phone in her pocket. I mean, all the time. She feels phantom vibrations of her phone. You know how you think your phone buzzed, but it really didn't? Yeah, I mean, she's feeling it all the time because she's thinking, oh, it's the baby, it's the baby. I mean, she can't wait. She's waiting patiently. Expectantly, she's expecting something to happen. That is the story here. It's like kids on Christmas Eve. Expectantly, they expect something to happen. And David is sinking in the muck, and he says, let me tell you about a time when I waited patiently on the Lord. And while I did that, the Lord inclined to me. Literally, God's attention was arrested and riveted to David's call, like a mother's ear is tuned to her infant's cry. Have you ever wondered? I mean, mothers get this magical sense when they have a child. I mean, it's like all of a sudden they have this amazing ability to hear the cry of their child. I mean, there's a nursery and all these babies are crying, and all of a sudden she goes, and she gets up and goes, and you're like, what? Oh, she was crying. You know, I mean, they have this amazing ability to hear that. And that's what God did to David's cry. He's sinking in the muck and mire, and he's waiting patiently, expectantly. He's expecting God to act. He calls out to God, and God leans in. His ear is tuned. Like a mother's ear to her infant, God's ear is towards you, and he hears your cry. I wanted to say this morning. You may be sinking in a bog. You may be stuck in a miry pit. And you're calling out to God. My friend, God hears your cry this morning. That's what David says. He hears my cry. And what God did, David says, and he's just telling the story of the past. What God did is he pulled me out. He extricated me from the bog, and he established my foot on a rock. He rescued me, and he secured me. What good would it be if God just kind of pulled you up and then let you go? I mean, he doesn't just pull you out of the mess. He sets you on solid ground. I was at the YMCA when my kids were young. They were taking swim lessons. How many of you parents here have put your kids in swim lessons? You've experienced the joy of swim lessons. Yes, okay, you've done it. You're there, you're sitting on the sidelines. There's a YMCA swim teacher, and he's in the water with all these kids. All the kids have these specific instructions, grab the side when the swim teacher's not with you, and so you see all these little kids, and they're holding onto the side like this in the pool. Just like they're supposed to. And the swim teacher takes one of them, puts this noodle underneath them. He's teaching them how to swim. He's doing that. All the kids are holding like this, like little rats in the pool, you know, just like this. Except for this one kid. He's 4 years old, and he is a terror. He's a brat. He is. He's the kind that, like, his life is like nails on a chalkboard. It's like, hey, kid, just listen, please. But he won't. He's 4 years old. So he's supposed to be there, like, with all the other kids, but he won't do it. And he's supposed to stay in the pool and wait for his turn, but he won't do it. And next thing you know, he's getting out of the pool, and his mom's there, and she's on her cell phone, negligent, you know. Like, man, mom? But she's not paying any attention. This kid's running up and down the side. You're not supposed to do that at the pool. And it's just a mess, and I'm watching this kid. And all of a sudden, the teacher's way down at the other end with one of the kids. All the other kids are like this, except for this brat four-year-old. And this little kid goes just like this. And jumps right in. I mean, just jumps right in the pool. He can't even swim for his life. I'll never forget this. Like one of the funniest things is, here's this four-year-old kid. His eyes are wide open, and his hand is up like this, and he's sinking below the water, just like that. And mom's still on her cell phone, and the teacher's way down at the other end. And so I get up and I go over there, and the kid's like looking at me. He's underwater, like looking at me like this. And what I did is I paused for a moment and I began to recite Ephesians 6:1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. No, I didn't do that. I wanted to do that, but I didn't do it. Here he is. He's got his hand up. And I reach down and I grab this kid and I pull him up with one hand like this. Now, what good would it have been if I'd have pulled him up out of the water and then let him go and walked away? Well, I guess he learned his lesson. In this passage, what does God do with us when we find ourselves in a bog, in a miry pit, in the muck of quagmire? He pulls us up out, but he doesn't just drop us then. Look, it says in verse 2, he drew me up from the pit of destruction, out of the miry bog, and then what does he do? Then he sets my feet on a rock and makes my steps secure. That's what God does for us. And so David is recounting God's goodness about how he did that in his life. God is so good. He pulled me up out of this bog, and he set my feet on a rock. He established my way. And as David is recounting the goodness of God in the past, he's actually being strengthened about his present situation. So pause for a moment. Why is it so important that when you find yourself in a bog sinking, that you begin to recount the goodness of God? Why is that so important? Because as you recount the goodness of God in the past, how he's been faithful to you, how he's rescued you in the past, all of a sudden it strengthens you in the present. Sure, it's uncertain, and sure, you're not out yet, but you're like, but God has always done that. I mean, he's always pulled me out. And suddenly you're calmed and you're strengthened. I mean, imagine if you were a Green Bay Packers fan, and you haven't watched the Green Bay Packers for 3 years. It's just been a busy season of life, but this year you decide you're going to start following them when it gets to the playoff time. And so you join some diehard cheeseheads, you know, the people that wear, like Daniel Mulder. I mean, he probably wears a foam cheese thing on his head, right? So you join some of those people, or like my mother-in-law. I mean, if you want to see something funny, just watch a Green Bay Packer game with my mother-in-law. I mean, you want to see her get up and yell at the TV. I mean, she's like correcting those. It's so hilarious. But you haven't watched for 3 years. It's playoff season. You decide to be a fair-weather fan. And so you sit with these diehard fans, and you're going to watch Green Bay. And you watch this first quarter, and the first quarter, they're down 3-10. And you're in despair. I mean, I don't know if they're going to make it. I mean, where's Aaron Rodgers? Where's the, you know, the double check thing that he does? I mean, what's up? You're wondering about that. And these diehard fans say, hey, Lucas, calm down, bro. Listen, every game this season, they've been down in the first quarter. They turn it on in the second, and they have an undefeated record. Now, if I knew that about all the past events, all those past games, then I probably could be calm, couldn't I? Like, okay, it's the first quarter. Every first quarter they've been down, but then they've won every single time. Like, go Pack, go. I'd be okay, right? Pause for a second. You're in this situation, this muck and mire. You feel like, oh no, what's going to happen? You begin to doubt, or you're in despair. You're questioning God, like, am I ever going to get out? Pause and look back. He's pulled you out of all of those situations. He's lifted you out of all of that clay, and he's set your feet on a rock. It's okay. You're going to be okay. And so as David recounts this, he's actually strengthening his own heart. And he's not just recounting it to himself. I want you to see, as you look in this text, he's actually proclaiming it abroad. Look at verse number 5. You have multiplied, O Lord my God, your wondrous deeds and your thoughts towards us. None can compare with you. I will proclaim them and tell of them. They're more than can be told. Listen, if you were to proclaim or try to shout out all the goodness of God, there's so many you can't even spend the rest of your life uttering them. If you were to take a piece of paper and just begin to write down how God has been good in your life, you'll run out of space. I mean, even if it was just the works of Jesus, in his 30-something years here on earth, John says he did so much good that if we tried to write him in books, the world couldn't hold all those books. I mean, God's goodness is so amazing. I've just got to proclaim it. He says, I will proclaim in verse 5, and I will tell of them. Fast forward to verse number 9. Notice how here's David. He's sinking in the muck and mire of his present circumstance, but he's reflecting back on the goodness of God, and he's just sharing it. He's just proclaiming it. He's yelling it out. God's been so good. Verse number 9. I've told the glad news of deliverance in the great congregation. Behold, I have not restrained my lips, as you know, O Lord. I have not hidden your deliverance within my heart. I have spoken of your faithfulness and your salvation. I have not concealed your steadfast love and your faithfulness from the great congregation. He says, I haven't held it in. I haven't kept it a secret. Like I hide God's goodness deep in my heart, and no one will know but me. Man, that's ridiculous. No, God is so good. I've just got to share it. That's what he's saying. I've got to proclaim it. Listen, friends, we do this all the time. When something's good in our life, we just tell people. It's just kind of natural. Like people come up to me like, hey, dude, have you seen this app? And they think it's the coolest thing ever. And it's like, hey, that's Angry Birds. That's been around for a while. I mean, you know, whatever it is. But they've got an app. They think it's so good. They want to tell people about it. Or there's an Xbox game that just came out. Dude, I like stayed up till 4 a.m. playing this. It's so good, you know, like, and they're just going to tell people about it. Or there's a restaurant that they eat at. Now, I'm a foodie. I was at a restaurant this last week. It's one of my favorite restaurants, Del Lago Al Mar. It's a Peruvian place. And I was there with Will, and the waitress comes up, and Will goes, I don't know if you know this, but Lucas is your best advertisement in the whole city. He tells everybody about it. That's what he told the waitress. I mean, he's telling, because I do. I mean, I have had some of the best food there. I mean, it's incredible. And I'm not getting paid by Del Lago Al Mar to say this. It's just good. And so I like to share that with people. I let them know, like, hey, if you want a good meal, you got to go to Del Lago Al Mar. When things are good, we just tend to share them. And here's the psalmist, he's saying, let me tell you about the goodness of God. It's better than that new movie, that new app, that new Xbox game, that new restaurant. It's better than all of that. I can't contain it. And so he just shares it. He sings about it. I mean, verse number 3, he put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many are going to see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. I mean, you almost get this picture of this dude, and he's just walking by himself just singing, and people are looking at him like, what are you doing? But he can't contain the goodness of God. Have you ever sung in public and you just don't care? I mean, you don't even have a good voice, but you don't care. You're just going to sing in public anyways. You're just going for it. Like you're in your car and you're just singing and people are looking at you and you don't care. You're hammering on the steering wheel. You're like, but you just don't care. I've had these moments in my life. There's been times where I'm on a bike ride. I'm listening to some just beautiful music about God. And all of a sudden I'm just singing on my bike and cars are past me looking at me like, what, that guy talking to himself? What's wrong with him? I don't care. Or I've been on a run and I've got my headphones in and there's been some great music about God and I just start singing. I don't care. In Liberty Park, listen up. And I just run, you know, I don't care. Sometimes God has just been so good to you. He just fills your heart with so much goodness. You've got to proclaim it. You've got to share it. You might even sing about it. And he puts that deep in your heart. And that's what's happening in the opening of this passage. David is just recounting the goodness of God. Even in the midst of trials, go back to the goodness of God in your life. I was listening to a sermon by D.A. Carson recently. And he's a professor at a seminary called Trinity. And he was recounting about a student that he had. He was a missionary down in Bolivia. Single guy, went down to Bolivia. While he was down there, he met a special someone, a female missionary down there who was also single. Single missionary, let's do missions together. That's what they said. We're better together. Next thing you know, these two get married down in Bolivia. But the mission thought so highly of this couple, they really wanted to invest in their education so that they could train leaders in Bolivia. So they sent them back to the U.S. to get training at this seminary called Trinity. Well, D.A. Carson talks about his time with this man. During their season of seminary, the young lady gets diagnosed, very young age, gets diagnosed with breast cancer. And it almost takes her life. She has a mastectomy. She survives. They have a child together. After the child's born, the guy gets stomach cancer. I mean, here's this young guy. I mean, here's these two young people. He gets stomach cancer, has most of his stomach removed, and ends up having to eat little nibbles of food to eat every couple hours because he has no stomach. And they're just continuing on going to school. Well, the woman's cancer comes back and she dies. He's got a little child. He finishes up school, goes down to Bolivia and serves a term on the mission field. Well, 4 years pass. He comes back up. He's got this child. He's a single man. He's lost his wife. He's battled cancer. He comes back to the church where D.A. Carson is. D.A. Carson said this, you know what struck me about this man? Is his life was riddled with trials. I mean, in our context, miry pits, riddled with trials. He said, but as he stood before our church the first half hour, all he could do is just declare the goodness of God. I'm going to tell you something. You are going to stir the hearts of people around you, and you are going to increase the faith of your neighbors, and your praise about God's goodness, even when you're in the midst of a bog, is going to be like a cup of cold water to those who are searching for God. That's why it's so important that when you're stuck in the muck and the mire, that the first thing you do is you just begin to recount the goodness of God, because it captures attention and gives glory to God. You look back on the past and it's full of miracles, and you look towards the future and it's full of God's good intentions, and you're strengthened in the present, even if you're in a bog. The first thing you do is recount the goodness of God. The second thing you do in this text we see is that when we're in the pit, we not only recount the goodness of God, but when we're in the pit, in this personally intense trial, We need to commit, to recommit ourselves in submission to God. I mean, the opening of the psalm, it talks about what we're supposed to do when we're in the bog. We're supposed to recount the goodness of God. We're supposed to give praise to Him. That's what we're supposed to do. But as we keep reading the psalm, it talks about where we're supposed to turn. So where do you turn when you're in the pit? Not what do? Where do you turn? It is interesting to watch people who are stuck in life, who find themselves under the thumb of a personally intense trial, and watch where they turn. I mean, even for a moment right now, where do you turn for help or deliverance or strength when you're in the midst of your trial? And here in this text, you look at the passage, verse number 4. It says, blessed is the man who makes the Lord his trust. You know what you really should do is you should be turning to the Lord. That's where you should be turning. You should be making this deliberate look towards God in reliance on Him, trying to find help from Him. That's what you should be doing. But you keep reading verse number 4, and what you find is that there are some people who turn to the proud. There are some people who go astray after a lie. What does that mean? Well, sometimes when people are in pits, they're tempted to turn to idolatry to get themselves out. They'll turn to the escape routes that proud people have. What is the identifying marker of proud people? They don't need God. There are times in our lives where we're stuck in a bog and we're looking around like, where do we turn? Oh, look at that person. Their life seems to be going okay. They don't have God. They seem to be doing just fine. Maybe that's the way out. No, my friend, that's turning to the proud. No, my friend, that's actually accepting lies. That's not true. But sometimes we're tempted like that. I mean, here we are in a bog, and there seems to be other apparent ways of escape. Proud people, maybe it's your favorite musician or an actor or a wealthy business person. And you say, wow, they seem happy and carefree. I can't see any bogs or quagmire in their life. Look at how they get out of those circumstances. And maybe you're tempted to think that money is the answer, or work is the distraction, or alcohol numbs the pain, or drugs help you forget, or illicit sex calms you down. Where are you going to turn when you're in your bog? Because some people are turning to the proud, and they're saying, oh, maybe that's the way out. Some people are embracing lies. They're thinking, I don't know if I really do need God. I mean, if God really was here, why would I be in the bog anyways? He says, no, blessed is the man that trusts in the Lord. Idolatry is not the answer. Don't look to places outside of God. That's not where help comes from. Idolatry is not the answer. But notice another temptation. I want to surface this one. It's in verse 6. It's kind of the exact same thing, but the opposite. The exact same thing, but the opposite. It's not idolatry. It's actually religiosity. Oh, I'm not going to go after those worldly things, those actors, those things, those bad things. I'm going to go after good things. But they're good things without God. Like in this passage, he says, in sacrifice and offering, verse number 6, you have not delighted. I mean, maybe if I just do more devotions, then God will get me out of this pit. Like, listen, I'm going to start saying my prayers because that's going to be my deliverance. I'm going to be kind to some people and I'm going to give a bigger check in the offering plate. That's going to do it. No, my friends, that's empty religiosity. In sacrifice and offering, you have not delighted. Look, keep going down. Burnt offering and sin offering, you have not required. No, that's not where escape comes from. Start reading your Bible, go to church more often, say a few more prayers, and then somehow you're going to manipulate God to treat you in a way that you want and somehow get you out of the bog. No, it's not found in idolatry and it's not found in religiosity. It's not in these external sacrifices that lack the real heart. That's not where it's found. Now, this one can confuse some people. I mean, you get to verse number 6, and here the psalmist is saying it's not in sacrifice and offering. It's not in burnt offering and sin offerings. And you're kind of like, well, God, aren't you the one that set that up? That's not the answer. You're the one that set that up. It's the sacrificial system. I want to suggest to you that the sacrificial system, is kind of like an employer. An employer wants to see the transcripts that prove you have particular degrees. An employer wants to see certificates that show you've been trained with particular skills. But at the end of the day, the employer doesn't want the certificates and the degrees. He actually wants the skills. He actually wants the knowledge that those things point to. So it is with the sacrificial system. At the end of the day, God didn't want meat per se. He wanted hearts that would submissively obey him and trust him and do these sacrifices. He wanted what these sacrifices pointed to or symbolized. The sacrificial system was supposed to point to God. It was a picture, but God was the reality. I mean, think about it for a moment. That's why he can say, in sacrifice and offering you didn't delight, in burnt offering and sin offerings you have not required. He could say that because actually the temple was the shadow of a heavenly temple. The Passover lamb was a shadow of the Lamb of God who would be slain for the sins of the world. The priesthood, it was just a shadow of a future great high priest. He didn't want them to fall in love with the shadow and neglect the reality. I mean, that would be as condemnable as going to a wedding and seeing this take place. Now, speaking of weddings, John and Jessica Moon are with us today, just back from their honeymoon. Congratulations. Can you imagine going to that wedding? And here's John and Jessica, and imagine that they had been doing a long-distance relationship, you know, the kind that was before Google Hangouts and Skype and the ones before all that technology. Like, imagine if they had a relationship where all they could do is just write to each other. Like, you know, the old school, like mail with stamps. Imagine if that's the only way they communicated. But somewhere along the course of the relationship, they sent each other a picture. And John just treasured this picture of Jessica. I mean, this thing was amazing. He took it with him everywhere. He had it in his pocket. I mean, he posted it in his office. I mean, everywhere. He's got this picture. This is going to be my future bride. And he falls in love with the picture. The wedding day comes. They're going to see each other in person. And John's up in front. I mean, he's dapper. He's got this amazing suit on. And he's standing up in front, right at the center aisle, you know, just like you're supposed to at a wedding. And he reaches into his pocket. And he pulls out the picture. And he just begins to stare at it. Ooh. The music begins, the processional. Jessica comes out in this white gown. Everyone stands. They're all looking. Little pieces of flowers are being dropped, and she's making her way down. But John's like, oh. I mean, he brings that picture in close and gives it a little kissy kiss. And Jessica's coming down, but he's in awe of the picture. His bride is approaching, but he can't take his googly eyes off of the photo. What would that be like? That's not what's intended. You're not supposed to fall in love with the picture. The picture's supposed to point to the reality. And that's why in this text he says, listen, these sacrifices, these burnt offerings, all these things, those are the picture. You're not supposed to fall in love with the picture. You're supposed to fall in love with the reality. You're not supposed to, I don't want more temple. I want you to think about the future temple. I don't want more of these Passover lambs. I want you to think about the Passover lamb. I don't want you to think about more of these high priests. There's one great high priest. Get your eyes off the picture and look towards the reality. That's what he's talking about here. And what is the reality? Well, don't turn to idolatry. Don't turn to religiosity. Turn to me, God says. Trust in me. That's verse number 4. Set your affections on me. Listen to me. In verse number 6, notice it says, in sacrifice and offering you have not delighted, but you have given me an open ear. Here's the Hebrew. In sacrifice and offerings you have not delighted, but you have dug out my ears. Dug out my ears. What does that mean? You dug out my ears. Now some translate this, you have pierced my ears. Because they're not sure, what does it mean to you dug out my ears? There was a tradition, it's in the book of Exodus, where if you were an indentured servant, so you're in debt, you can't pay your debt, so you say, I'll work for you for 3 years and pay off that debt by my work. And so you become a servant of this master, you do 3 years worth of work, you get to the end of those 3 years, your debt is paid, but you kind of really like this master. I mean, he takes care of you, he respects you, he provides for you, I mean, there's 30% unemployment in the ancient Near East. You don't want to be like that. You're kind of like, you know what? I'll just stay here. So he says, great, you want to be my servant for the rest of your life? Come on over here. I'm going to make you a bond slave. He takes this indentured servant who's now paid off his debt but really likes his situation. He takes him out to the back shed. He grabs his ear. He yanks it up like this, takes this maul, and he puts a huge hole right there in his ear. Just, I mean, talk about piercings, gauges. I mean, he had like a gauge, you know? Bam, big old hole in his ear. And that was to signify that, this is in the book of Exodus, that was to signify that for the rest of his life, he would be an indentured servant, or he would be a bond slave in this man's house. Maybe that's what it means. I mean, maybe God wants us to be like these servants, just that we're going to serve the Lord all the rest of our life. Not sacrifices, not offerings, just serve the Lord all the rest of your life. No, I don't think that's it. Every time that is talked about, it's only one ear. This one in the Hebrew actually has ears plural. You have dug out my ears. What I think this one means is more like your mother and how she treated you in elementary school when you didn't listen to her. And she's calling your name, she's telling you to clean your room, and you're playing your Game Boy. And she's like, nah. She comes up to you, and she looks at you and says, you listen to me, or we're going to march you right into that bathroom, and I'm going to clean the earwax out of your ears so you can hear what I'm saying. Do you know what I think this means? You have dug out my ears. I think it's the picture of God taking these Q-tips and cleaning out your ears so that you start listening to him. I mean, they didn't have Q-tips back then, but just imagine, sharp piece of rock or something that they used. I don't know. Sticks. I don't know what they did back then. But I mean, that's what he's talking about. You dug out my ears. Actually, you cleaned out my ears so I could start listening to you. God doesn't want your empty sacrifices and your religiosity. He actually wants you to start listening to him and obeying him. I mean, that's where it's at. Here you are, you're sinking in the bog, and what do you need to do? Don't turn to idolatry. Don't turn to religiosity. Turn to God. Trust him. Start listening to him. Start obeying him. You know what the tendency is when we are sinking in a bog? It's to listen to us. It's to think about our own escape routes. We tune God out. We're trying to figure it out. Stop and listen to God. Let him dig out your ears so that you will begin to do what he says. So that verse number 8, you'll actually delight in doing his will. That's what God wants. So if you're in a personally intense trial, a pit, you need to start by recounting the goodness of God, and then you need to recommit yourself in submission to God. You're not turning to idols. You're not turning to religion. You're recommitting yourself to God. That's what the psalm is telling us here. But there's one final thing as we close, and that's that when we're in a pit, we actually need to return to hope-filled dependence on God. Maybe you felt hopeless, or maybe you felt like, I'm sinking too fast, and if God doesn't move quick, I don't know what's going to happen. You've lost hope, perhaps, in the midst of your trial. Or maybe you've said, I've tried to get out of this sin struggle. I've tried to break this addiction cycle, and I just keep getting caught. My friend, God does not want you to lose hope this morning. Return to hope-filled dependence on God. The last portion of the chapter, I told you this, is David in a fresh pit. He's been talking about one he got delivered from in the past, but in verses number 11 through 17, he's in a fresh pit. And isn't that the way life works? I mean, it's kind of like every time God rescues us, we quickly find ourselves in need of rescue again. Every time God's delivered us, all of a sudden, here we are again. I need deliverance, God. And what we find is in this passage, God had rescued David and Israel from idolatry many times. He'd saved them from stupid mistakes over and over and over again. And David comes to this conclusion that he doesn't just need to be saved from some bad decisions. What David really needs deliverance from is he really needs full and final rescue. Like, God, I actually just need you to be my salvation, my help, my deliverer. Don't delay, oh God. And so in the rest of this text, what happens is David just talks about his situation right now. He says, I'm surrounded by evil that encompasses me, verse number 12. I'm overtaken by iniquities, the middle of verse number 12. I mean, my iniquities are so many, they're like the hairs of my head. If I try to number them, my heart fails. I can't do it. These iniquities, my sins this last week, this last month, this last year, are more numerous than the hairs of my head. Evil that surrounds me, the bad things in life, All the headlines that plaster the newspapers of things that are going wrong and evil and contrary to God, all of those things, it's like they're encompassing me. My sins are engulfing me. You read verses 13 through 15. He says, I've got enemies. They're overtaking me. What I need, God, is full and final rescue. That's what David longed for. Because this cycle of I need to be pulled out of the pit, I need to be pulled out of the pit, I need to be pulled out of the pit. Like, doesn't your heart just hope that one day you'll actually just be finally and fully pulled out of a pit? I mean, don't you just long for an existence where you don't have to fall in pits anymore? I mean, don't you long for that? I do. I mean, if you've struggled with sin for any length of time, or if you've been opposed for any length of time, there is something in your heart that just yearns for full and final rescue. And I think that's where David was. But who is it? I mean, who can really deliver us like that? Who can crush the evil that encompasses us? Who can conquer the enemies that mock us? Who can bear the iniquities that seem to cover us? Who can do that? Oh, friends, we need someone who'd be willing to enter the muck and mire of our lives with us. We need someone who could bear under the weight of enemies and evil for us. And that's where I'm going to close today, by showing you that there is someone like that. His name is Jesus, and he quoted this psalm. It's in the book of Hebrews chapter 10. In Hebrews 10, verses 5 through 10, we get the answer. Who is it that can give us full and final rescue? It's Jesus. The passage says this: when Christ came into the world, he said, and then it begins to give a quote of Psalm 40. Jesus said this. Jesus said, he personalized it, he quoted it, he said, sacrifices and offerings you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. In burnt offerings and sin offerings you have taken no pleasure. Then I said, behold, I have come to do your will, O God. The writer of Hebrews goes on and he says, now you know when Jesus said, behold, I have come to do your will, by that we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. Jesus quoted this psalm. He said, sacrifices and offerings, that's not what you wanted. You've given me a body. You've prepared for me a body. I have come to do your will, O God. And the writer of Hebrews says, what did it mean when Jesus said, I have come to do your will? He came to give his life. Jesus came to get into the muck so that you could get out of the muck. Jesus came to bear the weight of evil and enemies so that you could actually escape from evil and enemies. And how did he do that? The writer of Hebrews says he offered his body once for all. Where does full and final rescue come from? David was looking forward. It was blurry. But we look backward and it's crystal clear. Full and final rescue comes in Jesus. Jesus came not to do his own will, but the will of him who sent him. He came to be obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Could there be any worse pit, personally intense trial, than the pit of the cross? Jesus bore that so that he could offer life and freedom to all who believe. And I think that's why when we get to the end in verse number 16, those who have been saved from the pit, those who have received Jesus as their rescuer, their full and final rescuer, they say this: rejoice and be glad. May those who love your salvation say continually, great is the Lord. And so as we close this morning, if you've been rescued from the pit, then leave here and say continually, great is the Lord. Let's pray together.